to say to decolonize gives the power to colonization as a system, when in fact, our struggle in the 21st century is to indigenize.
This is Max Rameau, strategist, theorist, author, and organizer with Pan-African Community Action, and you are listening to The Next World. On this show, we explore and celebrate the work of poor people's movements, particularly in the U.S. We highlight innovative and powerful organizing campaigns and community building led by women, LGBTQ folks, Black communities, and other people of color that are pushing the boundaries and have the potential to transform society. Today on the show, we talk with Judith LeBlanc of the Native Organizers Alliance. Together, we discuss organizing in Native nations, protecting sacred spaces, lessons from Standing Rock, and celebrating victories. All right, Judith LeBlanc, thank you so much for joining us here on The Next World. I appreciate you being here. And you're from the Caddo Nation, is that correct?
A citizen of the Caddo Nation.
So can you tell us a little bit about the Caddo Nation, a little bit of the history, a little bit of the geography? Where is the land of the Caddo Nation situated in terms of the geography that most of us have been forced to understand?
Well, contrary to stereotypes about Natives and Indigenous people of the United States, many of our peoples were migrants. We migrated, sometimes due to colonialism, sometimes due to weather, sometimes due to hunting, sometimes for adventure, and, you know, sometimes for love. It's just like migrants in the 21st century. And so it was with my tribe, which is originally on the land in Louisiana, and then Spanish, French colonialism. We moved, some stayed behind, but we moved, migrated up into Arkansas and Texas. And then we, over generations, and then we signed our first treaty with the Texas Republic. And then we know what happened with the Republic. And at that point, we were driven by the U.S. government up into Oklahoma. So right now, our land is in Oklahoma, in Binger, Oklahoma, which is southwest of Oklahoma City. But we have historic markers all the way along of Caddoan culture, mound cities, pottery that go up from Louisiana. We're a Mississippi River tribe. That landed in Oklahoma.
Wow. So that, of course, makes the whole idea of history with land and relationship to land really complex because you have claims to several different pieces of land. And each claim, again, aside from the individual migration stories, as you mentioned, for love, for, you know, whatever other reasons, it really seems like it makes the history very complicated.
So complicated, but really instructive to understand what indigeneity is. It is a relationship to land. It is about understanding your relationship to land. And that means wherever you are. So indigeneity, if you are an Indian, 70% of us live in urban areas. If you're an Indian and you live in Chicago and you're second or third generation Indian in Chicago, your indigeneity has to play out within the context of knowing and caring for that land, that place, understanding the history of that place, and your role in it in protecting that place for the good of our descendants. So indigeneity is a concept that is shaped by migration, that is shaped by time, place, and circumstance, but always at its core, your relationship to place and your responsibility to place, to that land, to that air, to that water, and to future generations.
Yeah, I think that may be the thing that keeps it at center. Of course, I think about it in terms of relation to colonialism, but I think you're right that the objective, or at least the objective definition and the definition that will survive the test of time is actually your relationship to the land, not relationship to something that happens to be happening right now. And also, if you're just fighting against colonialism, then that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be a steward of the earth. And I think that we do need to do that over the long term.
This is a very important point you're making, because I know that many speak about we need to decolonize. From our historic experience, to say to decolonize gives the power to colonization as a system, when in fact, our struggle in the 21st century is to indigenize, to actually reclaim, restore indigeneity, restore our relationships to land, our rights and responsibilities to land and water. And decolonizing is a concept that has been coined, I think, to make it easier to understand the history, which has been whitewashed. You know, I'm using air quotes here, whitewashed. But in fact, it's very disempowering, in my opinion, if you're developing political strategies in the 21st century.
Yeah, and I think one of my favorite quotes from the late, great Kwame Ture, who was known as Stokely Carmichael way back in the day with all African People's Revolutionary Party, and of course, before that, with the Black Panther Party, and SNCC before that. One of his famous quotes that I hold dear is he talks about, I didn't really a quote, more of a concept. He talks about the idea that we can be against the same thing. For example, we're against police brutality. We are against oppression. We're against, but being against the same thing is not at all the same as being for the same thing. And ultimately, when we're organizing, we can't be about what we are against. It must clearly define what we are for. And I think this is something that you're hitting on right now with the difference between being decolonizing and indigenizing.
You know, it's so complicated for many of our peoples because we are slammed in the face, in the butt every day with the crisis problems of this system of capitalism.
Yeah.
And I think we're in a moment where people are realizing that in order to fulfill, from an indigenous framework, our ancestral responsibilities and our responsibilities to all of our descendants, and when I say ancestors, you know, Nelson Mandela is an ancestor of mine as an indigenous woman. And so all of our descendants, to fulfill the responsibilities to, in that indigenous time cosmology of the past and the future coming together in the present, we have to be mindful of not only what we're for, but how we're going to get there. Yes, we want education, housing for all. They shouldn't be privileges. They should be rights. For Native people, it's treaty rights. Those are treaty rights for us. We gave up land. We fought wars, we lost people, and signed agreements and treaties in order to assure the future for our descendants, and they've been long denied. But many of those things, in the final analysis, are human rights. Therefore, being able to how we struggle for those things determines a lot. It's a strategy. And for us, from the Native Organizers Alliance perspective, we are developing an Indian country spiritually directed or values directed strategy, because to be in balance and knowing what you're against, who your opponents are, what are the challenges very specifically, and to know what tactics, how do you move forward with your values intact?
With,
you know, the Navajos call it, the Navajos call it walking in beauty, where you are 360 degrees aware of all that is around you and you move with that force, you move together with those who have share a similar understanding. And so therefore, you're able to meet the challenges.
So you mentioned the Native Organizers Alliance, of course, of which you are the executive director. What is your path to being an organizer? Would you define yourself as an organizer? You would, right? Yeah, I think I've seen your quotes in a bit. What is your path to getting to becoming an organizer, not just in a casual way, but as a lifelong vocation?
So I'm an elder, and I've been to a lot of rodeos. And I don't mind saying that in the beginning, I was a FU organizer, you know? Anger was my best friend. I knew what I was against. And over time, the path that I've been able to follow has led me to a place of understanding that is kind of understanding the power of being in balance and being strategic. I have a lot of ex-husbands. And you know, the truth is that if I had understood 40 years ago what I understand now about how anger makes you less strategic, I probably wouldn't have so many ex-husbands. So my path really began with the occupation of Wounded Knee, 1973. There was a call for
the American Indian Movement.
The American Indian Movement, which was founded in, I think, 1967 in Minneapolis.
July 68, we just passed the anniversary.
68. I was a sophomore in high school, but it was founded in response to police killings. you know, systemic racism, it was founded. And the elders at Pine Ridge put out a call for the American Indian movement to come to protect them and establish a stronger fight for sovereignty, for self-determination. And so when that occupation happened, it was all over the news because it was in the middle of an upsurge against systemic racism. The Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, the Young Lords among Puerto Ricans, Brown Berets among Chicanos, you know, the women's movement, the anti-war movement. There was a surge, just like Standing Rock was in the midst of Black Lives Matter and the Fight for 15 and the Dreamers. So in that moment, I was in the surge. I felt the surge. I went to college at the University of Massachusetts. And when Wounded Knee happened in 73, I was on a Bureau of Indian Affairs scholarship, which they no longer give out, full ride with spending money, honey. It was the war, you know, the war on poverty. We were swimming in the channels of the war on poverty federal policies. And when that surge happened, I quit college, much to the chagrin to my family. I was the first one to graduate from high school. And the call went out for young Indians to come and to do the pretrial investigative work of for the hundreds, the largest number of federal indictments ever handed down in the post-occupation period. When I lived
The indictments as a result of the action at Wounded Knee.
Yes, as a result of the action at Wounded Knee and the federal government sending in the National Guard and federal and the FBI. And they arrested all of those people who had taken a stand. They were, you know, it was a forced occupation. It wasn't a direct action that was will. We were forced into it, surrounded by federal agents. And it was a 73-day standoff, which resulted in hundreds of Indians being indicted. So I went, lived at Pine Ridge from 73 to 74 with the Wounded Knee Offense and Defense Committee in Porcupine, collecting evidence. And I used to drive the evidence, no cell phones, no, you know, computers, drive the papers with type and put them in a file and drive to Minneapolis. They grabbed the papers.
And by file, you mean in your Google Docs is what you mean, right?
Yes. Yeah, there were no Google Docs. And then I recently met the woman who was doing all the Xeroxing for the lawyers, because, you know, Kunstler, all these famous lefty lawyers who were defending the Panthers and the Young Lords and Brown Berets. So that's how it began for me. And when I was there, I met people who understood the nature of systemic racism. I also met people who did not have a strategic understanding of racial capitalism. Mm. But I learned that it was systemic, that it wasn't just a bunch of white people who were doing the wrong thing, or Indian people for that matter. It was about the system. So that's how I became an organizer. And I have had such a great opportunity. I have no pension plan, but I do have had a great opportunity all of my life to be involved in community organizing and struggles. From there, I worked on welfare rights organizing in the mid-70s in Springfield, Massachusetts, doing takeovers of welfare offices, organizing welfare recipients to demand our rights, and police crimes in Springfield. 9 Black and Puerto Rican youth were shot in the back of the head by the police at that time. And we formed a coalition, labor community coalition. And then I even worked as a court-appointed observer of the desegregation process of the Boston school system and worked in South Boston High School under Judge Garrity, which was in 1976 and 75, 76. So I've had eyewitness kind of relationships to some turning point struggles, but actually the Native Organizers Alliance, these past 8 years, I've learned about what organizing political power means.
As opposed to mobilizing protest against those who actually have political power.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is an important turn. And I feel like this is a turn that I guess I'm trying to understand if this only happens with age. I feel this. You're telling me your path and I'm feeling it in a real, you know, in my bones, because I am recognizing the ways that I have transformed my thinking, not in terms of the way I understand the system, but in terms of I understand my role in overturning the oppressive systems, and the difference between mobilizing and against and tearing down, which of course has to happen with the demolition, but also what are we building in its place? And if we don't deliberately build in its place, then what does that do? So what does that mean that is going to happen as a result? And also, as you're describing this, I'm thinking about the relationship between some of the indigenous and Indian movements and some of the Black Power movements. And I'm thinking about two major times here. First is the founding of AIM, of the American Indian Movement, in July 1968. So shortly after the Black Panther Party was founded, and right around the same time as the, as you mentioned, the Brown Berets and the Young Lords and all these other groups, which of course, you know, to me underscores the importance of good analysis. Like, I think there's many people who think there are great individuals who change history, but the fact that so many of these things are happening at the same time, not just in the US, but all around the world at the same time frame, to me says that material conditions produce people who we later on call great individuals. And I think in particular, the American Indian Movement, some of the really important work around Wounded Knee, some of the takeovers of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, some of these other things inspired the Black Panther Party to up their game a little bit. And when the Black Panther Party and the Black Power Movement in general was crushed by the U.S. government in the early 1970s, the American Indian Movement was holding the hard left. Like, that was the only force left. The Black Panther Party was murdered, jailed, fled the country for their own safety, just all these different things. But the American Indian Movement kept at it, which I think was inspiring to many. And then the second big one was the other one, which you mentioned and which you have a lot of experience in, was in Standing Rock, where Standing Rock presented this new way of thinking about, certainly not new in any, but new way, I think, for a lot of the young organizers who think of themselves as part of this movement of Black people today, of relating to land, of relating to one another, of how protests could happen. So I think those are two big. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between indigenous Indian organizing and how that impacts the broader movement in the U.S. of organizing?
What you said, I really agree with, because social movements make change. Social movements create the basis for leadership. And as you said, social movements also change the conditions under which we organize. Mm-hmm. So in this moment, I would say since September 11th, which was a big interruption politically in the economic sphere, social sphere, it was a huge international interruption.
Oh, yeah.
And set into motion wars, set into motion a crackdown on civil rights and liberties in this country. And what has happened from then till now has been a period of social movements surging. You had a million people on the day the world says no to war, the first anti-war demonstration against the launch of the war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And since then, you've had major moments where, in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, the New York Times reported that one third of the adult population went into the streets. We never had that in the civil rights movement. And they were marching against systemic racism. So what you have is that social movement surging and creating new norms. So I would say from the war in Iraq through Black Lives Matter, I mean, there's other things, but Black Lives Matter, the anti-globalization movement just prior to the anti-war movement, and then Black Lives Matter, the Fight for 15, the Dreamers, Standing Rock, has created a new norm in this country, mm-hmm. where if something egregious is happening, you must, if you are a person of conscience, go into the streets, get with your family and friends, and say it loud and proud. This is wrong. We want something else. And I think if for the organizing world, it's created a dilemma. What role do organizations play? And that's what the Native Organizers Alliance grew out of. We grew out of the surge. I became the executive director the year before Standing Rock. Mm. We have been in a surge moment. And what does it mean for a group that's a national organizing training network? What does it mean, this whole surge, though, for the NAACP? What does it mean for the labor movement? What does it mean for Black community nonprofits? It means that we have to recognize that all of those people that were in that uprising around an array of issues, mm-hmm. where do they find a home to actually develop and dream together about structural changes that lead us in the direction of system change?
Right.
So organizations like the Native Organizers Alliance, and there are many others, Illuminated, NDN Collective, Advanced Native Politically, there's a number of us that have all come together because we're spiritually aligned about the need for the achievement of sovereignty, and that sovereignty is not going to happen tribe by tribe. And it's not going to happen without the majority of people in this country supporting it, which means it's not going to happen without system change, yeah. period, full stop. Yeah. So therefore, NOA, Native Organizers Alliance, we're creating an infrastructure, an ecosystem for leadership development through trainings where we bring elected tribal leaders, spiritual leaders, community organizers together to share experiences, to build on our traditional ways of building community. We have survived and continue to thrive because we've been organizing since dirt. Native communities have been organizing since dirt. That's a fact. We're the only peoples of color that have land base that's been collectively self-governed since the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of experience, good, bad, and ugly, on democracy. So therefore, Native Organized Alliance creating an infrastructure to generalize what in our cultures, you know, we have one of the most diverse peoples, and because we have so much experience, but our cultures are all very different. What is it in our tribal cultures that leads towards collective action, that mm-hmm. draws us, because of our values, towards coming together and challenging the system? That's the role of our trainings. That's the role that we play in working with tribal leaders and traditional and community organizers on the ground. And we work on the ground, invited in to help support the building of sovereignty, treaty rights. So, for example, we're working with a tribe on the Missouri River to regain co-management rights of 150 miles of the Missouri River, to restore it to health and to protect our rights to hunt and fish, all of our rights, not just Native rights, hunt, fish in a good way, and to make sure that that's protected for our descendants. So we're creating an infrastructure to build leadership to achieve sovereignty, which cannot happen without system change.
Without system change. So this is the analysis that I think is so important. So, of course, millions of people, not millions of people didn't show up at Standing Rock. Millions of people were in some level of solidarity with Standing Rock because they were against, for one reason or another, back to the theme of against this thing versus war, against the Dakota Pipeline access. And people were against it for all kinds of reasons. Some people didn't want continued dependence on fossil fuels. Some people thought corporations were too powerful. Some people were just concerned about the way that the decision was made, didn't follow all of the rules. So we're really into what the rules were. So they were against it for another reason. But then I think the important part is then what are we doing with when we have this million people who are interested, how are we then organizing them and making them for the same thing? And your analysis around organizing for sovereignty, I think, is the one that makes the most sense. So, but on that, let's then shift to the next logical thing. And this is where I first, of course, became aware of the Native Organizers Alliance. What was the role of Native Organizers Alliance in Standing Rock? And what, you talked a little bit about your leadership development program. What are the kind of things that the Alliance is doing right now?
So our strategy is based on experience, life experience. In Indian country, in order to maximize our political power, we need to have elected tribal leaders, our sovereign leaders, our traditional spiritual leaders, and our community organizers and activists on a good day walking on the same path, minimally walking in the same direction. That's what maximizes our power and allows for authentic and creative relationships with non-natives. So at Standing Rock, we went into that situation. There were only three other national networks, Indigenous Environmental Network, Honor the Earth, and I think that was it. There were three national networks. Mm-hmm. The majority of the leadership of the over 10,000 person camp were tribal leaders. Tribes, over 200 tribes supported that action. They supported it for one reason only, no matter what they thought about fossil fuels: sovereignty. The sovereign right of the Standing Sioux tribe
to make decisions about their own land
and their water. Yeah. As the struggle unfolded, the leadership of that tribe began to realize, because of practice-based evidence, that they were actually standing up for the health and humanity and protection of 17 million people who live downstream, who live, love, play, and work along the shores of that
river. Mainly white people, right?
Yes, because...
Yeah. So once again, you are saving white people for themselves, from other parts of their own community.
Or saving them from the destruction of fossil fuel industry, more so.
Yeah.
Because we had a global movement in solidarity, and there were many white people who joined that and stood with us. And that's the medicine of struggle that is based on values, because the main message, without any professionals, that came out of Standing Rock is that water is life. So you had people in Okinawa marching in Japanese, chanting, "Water is life," because in Okinawa, the expansion of U.S. militarism has created a crisis in housing, has created a crisis in the quality of water and access to good conditions for fishing. So for Native Organizers Alliance, our strategy, we therefore worked on the ground in the camp. We've been running trainings that allow people to explore basic concepts of organizing grounded in traditional belief systems. So on any given day at Standing Rock, we had between 10 and 20 people who had been through our trainings who would come together as a caucus from many different camps, you know, different Rosebud camp. Every tribe had their own camp and some really good food, I'll tell you. And we worked with the traditional Osheti Shekoan leadership. So it was the first time that the Osheti Shekoan tribes came together since the Battle of the Little Bighorn, when they handed the U.S. the biggest military defeat ever. Mm-hmm. And that traditional leadership, the Council of the Seven Fires, had not been together until that. And they recreated and reestablished traditional governance of that camp, and including protection. And I'm using air quotes here, law enforcement, security, to try to restore a balance. Because when you get 10,000 Indian people together, we bring all our social problems.
Right.
You know, violence, drugs, alcohol, domestic abuse.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we worked with the Osheti leadership to help deepen the appreciation of what this meant to restore our traditional ways. And we worked with the elected tribal leadership, Chairman Dave Archambault, who is a far-sighted, strategic Native leader. And we supported, for example, we did not raise any money. None. We did not send out any fundraising.
Any fundraising letters
for Native Organizers Alliance at all. We actually.
Why didn't you?
Because it was the sovereign leadership and the Osheti traditional leadership who were leading that struggle. We were there to support and assist. Hmm. So we created the opportunity to and actually built a list for the tribe of 200,000 people. We raised $350,000. Flowing through a MoveOn account into an independent account to support the work of the tribe. You know why? The tribe was laying off tribal employees in order to use money to support that camp, because it went on for months. And then we conducted trainings. We conducted trainings on the ground, you know, about power mapping, on organizing, and engaged with, you know, the traditional leadership, elected tribal leaderships from other tribes outside of Standing Rock, and the grassroots folks who were there. So we also did a lot when it came to narrative change work. We actually facilitated the first front page article in the New York Times about the attack on the people who went to the gravesites that were desecrated by the pipeline company, and helped to galvanize over 1,000 very prominent museum directors to stand with us about protecting our sacred sites. So we played like kind of a multi-layered role with grassroots, traditional leaders, and the elected leadership. And for us, we learned so much, and so did Indian country. Some people say we lost because the oil is still flowing. Well, we're still fighting.
Yeah.
But what we won was a sense of the power of direct action, the sense of the power of united action, and the sense of the power of solidarity, and the incredible nature of mass social movements that can galvanize for years to come. And we are still riding on that upsurge now,
yeah,
where people are engaged in over 60 co-management projects when it comes to water and land. And it was that way was opened by Standing Rock, which also contributed to the defeat of Trump. Sure.
You know, the idea that we lost a campaign that was that got so much attention and moved so many people to either come directly or to provide other types of support or to themselves get involved in their local communities and for other movements, you know, related movements, but other movements nonetheless, to mimic some of the actions and some of the behaviors. I think calling that a loss is really being very narrow about the way we're thinking about it. And if ultimately we're building movements and trying to build power for the long term, then there's no way to see that as anything but an incredible victory. I certainly see it as only a victory. I never even think about the idea that one demand was lost. I think about the way that entire achievement sparked a bunch of other things, certainly inside the Black community, but even in the larger context of movement building in the U.S.
Max, you're bringing up an important conundrum we're in. How do you analyze if something is a win or a loss?
Yep.
Because it's never just one or the other. It never is. That's Western thinking at its worst, this binary thing. Right or wrong. It's a win or a loss. Because you take a look at, for example, the Biden administration's decision on the Willow Project in Alaska, the project to allow drilling in the Arctic. Well, the truth is, that was a win and a loss. And some people said, see, Biden, sell out. He's, you know, he's not for, you know, acting on climate change. Deb Haaland, the first Native woman to be in the cabinet and to head up the most important department in the lives of Native people, the Department of Interior. But what that decision about the allowing the drilling was a reflection of the balance of power. The fossil fuel industry has more power than we all
have. Absolutely.
And they are still powerful, but we are challenging them. That project was underway for over 10 years. The way the legal system is controlled by powers greater than ourselves, the rich and arrogant and the powerful, the Biden administration could see they would be locked in a court battle.
Also, the Biden administration is getting money from them, and we would have to inflict more financial damage in terms of the way that we protest than they derive in benefits from the policy. So this really is where the balance of power, I think, is demonstrated, is that we don't have these levers that we can pull with them. We're certainly not going to bribe elected officials. So then how do we build a movement that's strong enough to counteract the amount of money they get from the...
But guess what? Our power was shown, though, in the fact that, number one, they created a buffer zone. Number two, they took for wildlife and hunting and fishing for subsistence, they took away some of the leases.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, if the movement, Indigenous-led environmental justice movement, had not been on the ground fighting for the last several years, the last decade, from Standing Rock to KXL Pipeline, on and on and on, we would not have been assured.
We've gotten to those things. Although I have to say, I completely agree with that there. I have to say, though, I think I think you started out saying that the analysis that Biden is a sellout, et cetera, is not. I think what you're pointing to is to the strength of indigenous organizing, native organizing, and in the broader movement that at least that it could tap into. And the fact that the Biden administration has to be aware and cautious of it, and is therefore forced to make these concessions a way of making sure that you did not unleash another storm here, which they couldn't afford politically.
But, you know, forced or not, we have to take the win. We have to understand what it is. Mm-hmm. It's a freaking cold shower for us to say publicly, we are not strong enough to stop the fossil fuel industry. Sorry.
Yeah.
Full stop. That's the situation we're in. We've got to organize and we've got to keep the pressure on. And I have to say that the assessment of individuals in elected office also has to be done from a power analysis. You know, like the debt ceiling agreement. You know what the media was saying? Biden's such a good negotiator. He's so good at it. Baloney. It's not one individual. In that situation, when the debt ceiling standoff was happening, Wall Street was telling the Republicans, get this shit done. They were telling the Biden administration, get it done. You're screwing us. They both had motivation to get something done. What we did have on our side of the table was that the elections, the elect, who, how are they positioning themselves? Mm-hmm. And the Biden administration, you know, was very smart at using the political situation, but they both were subject to the same pressures. So it wasn't Biden. He may be a very nice guy. Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe not. We don't know. That's not our area of concern right now. We don't want to have lunch with him. Not to engage him in the power dynamic. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not true.
So the Native Organizers Alliance has done a lot of leadership development work in the form of organizer training, as you call it. You do power building, which is direct organizing, or at least organizing of organizations. And you're working on, it seems to me, maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth or prioritize the work of your work, but placing a lot of attention on sovereignty, certainly the public policy of sovereignty for treaties. Talk a little bit about your other area of work, which is the sacred places preservation. What is that?
In 1978, it was finally our religious practices, our spiritual protocols, our ceremonies were legalized. Up until 1978, it was illegal to engage in what my family did, which was a peyote church, the Native American church, NAC, as we call it in Indian country. So in 1978, it was finally an act of Congress, which is a reflection of the fact that we have nation-to-nation status. We have signed treaties that constitutionally guarantees our rights. Unfulfilled, but nevertheless, the place where we start our fights. So the protection of sacred places all over the country, there are places where our people since time immemorial have gone to collect herbs, to conduct ceremony, but they've been taken, stolen, defaced, on and on and on, right? So we made a push because we saw all over the country, many places, local fights, local organizing, individual negotiations with the federal government, tribe with the federal government. And we said, no, we need to leverage that organizing and that concern in Indian country into some kind of national manifestation, which will maximize the pressure on the Biden administration to take action in protecting sacred places. It just so happened that the House of Tears, the Lummi traditional carvers, had carved a 25-foot, 5,000-pound totem, and they wanted to do a national tour highlighting the struggle. They called on us. We said, we're in. So we brought 17 nations together. We did a two-week, kind of Standing Rock on wheels, a totem journey from sacred place to sacred place for 2 weeks, towing that totem with about 20 vans, vehicles. And we went from place to place on the Snake River with the struggle to protect salmon, to Chaco Canyon, the struggle to end fossil fuel extraction, to Bear's Ears, to the Black Hills. We went Line 5, the headwaters of the Mississippi. And then we brought that totem to D.C. and we gifted it to the Biden administration. Now, let me tell you, that sounds nice. It took negotiations. It was the quickest acceptance of any kind of gift, because accepting that totem was bringing the prayers of thousands of people across the country who were protecting, fighting to protect their sacred places into the federal hands to remind them of their responsibilities to care for these places. So we've been working on legislation. We've been working to support the tribal and grassroots negotiators around Bear's Ears, where a settlement has been reached. Chaco Canyon, the same thing. Our managing director has been involved in that struggle for over 10 years. So we're supporting the work on the ground to finish off and finalize what we can with the urgency of knowing that the Biden administration only has about a year left. And they have created more national monuments and done more to protect our sacred places than has been done since the creation of the National Historic Preservation Act, NEPA, which was over 10 years ago. So that's the kind of work we do. We help prepare people to advocate on their own behalf. We raise the issues and the concerns up for national attention through our narrative work. And we organize online pressures. So, for example, we have a list over 200,000 people. We sent on behalf of the Grand Canyon at supporting those eight tribes that were fighting for the protection of Grand Canyon from uranium mining. I think it ended up being 75,000 letters to the White House. It's that, but you know, so you're adding your drops into the bucket to press for action. And, you know, in organizing movements, you have to be on the ground, you have to be in the air in the narrative struggle, and you have to be advocating policies that can be acted on by those who have the power to do so.
Who are your partners? Who else is doing this kind of work? And I don't just mean the sacred space, so that's included, but the sovereignty work, the organizer. Who are your partners? Who are you working with locally? Who are you doing this with? Who are you doing this kind of work with nationally?
So we're working with an array of tribal leaders, from Navajo to the Osheti Chacon to the Northwest. We're working with tribal leaders who are leaning into sovereignty, supporting them with trainings and advocacy around an array of issues: water, land, sacred places. We are working with other Native groups that are aligned with us, like Illuminative, a national narrative change organization, NDN Collective, that is kind of the, I'm the chair of their board, just for transparency's sake. It's like the one-stop shopping of organizing and economic regenerative development funding and technical support. And we're working with Advanced Native Political Leadership, which is an organization co-founded by Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, the only statewide elected Indian person in the country, who in Minnesota.
In Minnesota.
And then a state representative from South Dakota, Kevin Killer. And it's to support Native candidates to run and how to manage campaigns. So they do a lot of training. So between the four of us, we have a division of labor that covers all fronts. We're more grassroots. We have the folks working on building elected representation. We have the folks on economic, regenerative economic development. And then we have the real, you know, powerhouse narrative change folks who are working with Hollywood, working online to interrupt the dominant narrative of who we are. Others that we're working with, like the Native American Rights Fund, it's a decades old Indian law collaborative. And they've argued cases before the Supreme Court. We're working with them right now on a Native Voting Rights Act that we're trying to push through Congress to guarantee that we have protections against the many, many majority of states who passed very restrictive voting laws. We work with the Sierra Club on the local level and nationally. We've worked quite a bit with 350. We're working with the National Alliance of Tribal Historic Preservation Officers Association. They're the tribal folks who do work on cultural surveys and the protection of sacred. You know, it's an array of groups.
And do you find the tension that you're having? It seems like you're working a lot with elected officials, not just as targets of your campaign, but also kind of internally doing political education, as you mentioned, with folks who are either in office already or running for office. Is there tension between the grassroots component of your work and the elected official or aspiring elected official component of your work, particularly given the fact of the anger, the thing that we talked about a little bit earlier, where you may probably have a lot of members who are really angry at the government. And then you have other folks under your umbrella who are also part and parcel of that same government.
Well, you know who gravitates towards us. They're the ones that are elected officials because they were community organizers, because or they recognize after having been elected the power of grassroots organizing. And for Indian country, we're not like the Black community and other communities that have had people in elected office forever. For example, the first two Native women to be in Congress was in 2018.
Yeah, just really
2018.
Recently.
Yes, we haven't had our Barbara Lee or our Maxine Waters for our children to see. Exactly. Yeah. So we played a great role with Illuminative in organizing the grassroots pressure on the Biden transition team to nominate Deb, because they wanted Udall for the Department of Interior Secretary, cabinet position.
Level position, and yes, that's right.
We mobilized 19,000 people immediately to pressure them to nominate her, and then mobilized 80,000 letters, 40,000 to the Senate, 40,000 to the House, to secure a nomination. So in Indian country, we see that representation matters. It's huge. Deb Haaland, for example, just convened a commission, and within a year of her taking that position, it erased over 750 racist, misogynistic terms from geographical locations across the country. The S word, squaw, erased, because she was in that position, understood it was a priority, and knew that it would be a step
really towards... is very similar to the Confederate statues, where you have these official names that are inherently derogatory.
For everyone. It affects everybody's morals, and white children as well as children of color. And the truth is that, for example, Indigenous Peoples Day, instead of, you know, Columbus Day changing to Indigenous Peoples Day, was happening at the same time as this huge fight around removing Civil War Confederate symbols and the flag. Those movements were happening and feeding off of one another. So these kinds of things are done when we are able to galvanize at the grassroots, but also have allies on the inside. And so therefore, representation matters. It's not a destination. It's a situation that we can create. So we're negotiating with on one side of the table with people that we know and trust on the other side of the table. It's an inside-outside strategy. We have to use every tool in the toolbox to build up.
Those folks then have to come from movement rather than being placed there as tokens. But they really have to come from movement. Otherwise, it's
later in life realize that the movements make change, not them. And there are people like that.
So what's around the corner? So I think for me, Standing Rock took me completely by surprise. I was thrilled with it, of course, but it took me by surprise. What's around the corner? What are the issues? What are the ideas? And of course, recently in the news, we've had all kinds of other things. We've got the expose of the Indian schools, Indian boarding schools. We have had recently, even more recently than that, exposés on the missing Indigenous Native women who the police are not even bothering to look for. We haven't seen mass movements on this. We've seen a lot of things on the boarding schools, but we haven't seen like mass mobilization. What's coming up next that we should be keeping an eye out on, where we're either going to have mass mobilization or it's going to be something that will be critical to the movement and critical not only to the movement of Indigenous folk, but critical to it is going to cross over and hit other movements as well.
Okay, let's start with the small. We're going to be watching the Emmys because a made-for-TV movie called Prey, you all should watch it, got 8 nominations. So we're going to be watching the Emmys in September, and we're wishing, you know, the actors and the screenwriters, you know, much luck. And we want them to go back to work because there's many more stories to be told from all of us. We are also going to launch the third iteration of the first ever Native survey, National Survey of Native Peoples. Several thousand in 2020 under, you know, extreme conditions of COVID, where we were surveying in the most infectious places in the country, like on Navajo and the Menominee Reservation in Wisconsin and other places. We did the first ever survey, Native Survey of Native People. And you have to understand that statistics, we were told forever that we were statistically insignificant. So, you know, the Labor Department never collected unemployment statistics having to do with Indians until last year in April, they started under the Biden administration. They're not releasing the figures on the regular, but at least now they're collecting and understand that we are politically significant. We may be 5 million, but we're politically significant. We control land and resources.
Interesting that that's when they start collecting the data, is when they perceive you're being politically significant, not because
politically significant. So what we're looking at is doing another survey launching on Indigenous Peoples Day, where we'll be, you know, doing a narrative war as well as being on the ground and collecting what are the key issues in the 2024 elections? Where do we want to go? What does the future look like? And at this point, we are a critical feature to defending democracy from the extreme right and the rise of the extreme right. Why? because our treaties are constitutionally guaranteed. If you start undermining the Constitution, you start undermining the whole basis for Native nations to exist and to demand the rights that have been unfulfilled, and organizing the federal government to do what they need to do to fulfill our rights. So we also have become the object of increasing voter suppression. You look at places where we are large voting swing votes. In seven states, we are the determining vote on 77 electoral votes in the national elections, full stop. In Senate races, like in Montana, we are the vote that led to Tester winning. When he went to bed, when he ran 6 years ago, he thought he lost. When he woke up, the Crow and Northern tribal votes came in. He won by exactly the number of people who voted, 2,300 and something. And he had to say, yeah, it was the Indians. So we are preparing with this survey to begin to engage in communities and double the number of moccasins on the ground who we worked with. We had 100 moccasins on the ground in five states where we are the swing vote, places like Wisconsin and Michigan, Arizona, New Mexico. We are going to be full tilt. Indian country is on full alert to defend democracy and to engage in the elections. Why? Because it'll be a snapshot of our political power. We don't view elections as a destination either. The elections are just a reflection of where our organized political power is at and creates the new conditions to continue the work on sovereignty after the elections. So immediately following the 2020 elections, we had to jump onto the horses and get saddled up to push for the first Native to be nominated for a cabinet position, because they understood our power, they recognized it, they acknowledged it in the swing states. And so we said, this is the opportunity. And so we galvanized with Illuminative the grassroots support and pushed and got her done. So in Indian country, we recognize that we have political power that needs to be exercised on behalf of our people and for democracy and for economic justice and to lead towards a basis for system change. So we're going to be saddled up and if your listeners are in states where there are tribes and urban Indian communities and you're working on voter engagement, you better introduce yourself, get connected, because we're fired up.
So how can people learn more about your work, about the work of the Native Organizers Alliance? How can they support the work?
First of all, sign up for our email list. You're going to learn so much, because we don't speak on only the issues of concern for Indians. We give you an inside peek on how decisions that are being made affect Indian people and why we have common cause. So you should go to nativeorganizing.org. and sign up for our e-list. Some emails you'll find interesting, others maybe not, but it'll give you an opportunity to express your opinion. We leverage the political power of that list over and over again. We also on Facebook and Twitter, of course, but I have to admit, our TikTok is rocking. We just did a very powerful music video with our theme song. And you know what our theme song is? And if you don't know who did it, I'm going to be ashamed of you, Max. It's Come and Get Your Love by who?
I don't know.
I'm very upset, Max.
Any music made after 1989, I probably have not heard of.
Okay. It's a 70s thing. Redbone.
Redbone. Yeah.
Come and Get Your Love. And you can see that on our TikTok where we did
it. I cannot believe I didn't remember that.
Yes.
Yes, I know Redbone. Yeah.
And I just want to say in closing that if your listeners have not watched Rumble, which is on Netflix, it's about the history of Native people and rock and roll, baby. We got a history. We just lost a great Robbie Robertson from the band. And he plays a very big role in telling the story of the history of Natives in rock and roll. So watch Rumble on Netflix.
All right. Very good. So Judith LeBlanc, thank you so much for joining us here on The Next World. We appreciate it. And we look forward to hearing more from you and your organization in the future.
Thank you so much.
Okay, that's our show. Thank you for listening to The Next World. I'm Max Rameau. You can find out more about my work at pacapower.org. That's pacapower.org. You can read more in depth on many of the issues that we talked about today on the Partners for Dignity and Rights website, dignityandrights.org. We'll be back with another episode of The Next World soon. Until then, please tell your friends about us and help us spread the word about this podcast. Bye for now, and remember, organize, organize, organize.